Good evening, everyone. My apology that I am late. The plan was for me to get to my hotel before sunset, check my emails, change my clothes, and be here in plenty of time. But everything went according to plans until north of Florence. There is a bridge that is being repaired, and the freeway became parking, and then we moved a little bit, then we parked again and moved a little bit, and about an hour and a half later, here I am. So, but I am glad you are here, and I praise God that He brought me here. Do you mind if we pray before we begin? Let's pray. Father, in spite of everything, I'm here, so I praise You that You brought me here, and I praise You most of all that You brought all these people here, and I pray that Your Holy Spirit will guide us as we discuss the health matters this weekend. And I pray that after tomorrow, we'll know what we need to do in order to take better care of this body, which is the temple of Your Holy Spirit. Bless us, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. You did notice I speak with an accent, didn't you? You do too, right? Sometimes I joke that I was born in Mississippi. And that's where the accent comes from. I am from Poland originally. And you know what? My favorite Bible text is from the 2 Samuel, chapter 7, verse 18, where David says, "Who am I and what is my house that you have brought me this far?" Because he brought me from this little village in Poland to the United States and to teach nutrition at the State University in North Carolina and teach people about nutrition in places like this church here. And so I praise God for him. And I love to do these type of seminars, and I pray that you will learn a lot. The pastor asked me to discuss cancer prevention tonight, and so that's what we will be focusing on. So without any further delays and introductions, I want to share with you a little bit about cancer statistics, and then we'll look at very few simple principles of how we can prevent cancer from developing, okay? Cancer is the second cause of death in the United States after heart disease. So a lot of people, as you can see on the right-hand side, almost 600,000 people die as a result of cancer in the United States. And really, regardless of where we go, I had the privilege of lecturing in different countries, and really regardless of where we go, whether we go to countries like Japan, for example, which has one of the highest life expectancy, cancer is the leading cause of death. Whether we go to developing countries like Brazil or Ecuador, for example, cancer is the leading cause of death. And in fact, many of the other most frequent causes of death in the United States are the most frequent causes of death in other countries as well. What I will share with you is largely based on this document. This document was published by two prestigious organizations that deal with cancer prevention. As you can see here, World Cancer Research Fund, that's an organization from London, England, and American Institute of Cancer Research, that's an American institution from Alexandria, Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And they issued a document in which they outline very simple principles of cancer prevention that any one of us can follow. And that's the beauty about it. We don't have to rely on someone else. We can implement these principles in our own lives. And before I share with you these principles, let me read a quote or two from this document. Here's the first one. "In our view, the evidence reviewed here that led to our recommendations provides a wonderful opportunity to prevent cancer and improve global health." And notice, I already mentioned this, but this actually comes from this document, from these organizations. Notice, individuals and populations have in their hands the means to lead fuller and healthier lives. And then the father stated the following: to the extent that environmental factors, and these environmental factors include diet, nutrition, physical activity, things of that nature, okay, such as notice food, nutrition, and physical activity, influence the risk of cancer. It is, what does it say in there? It is a preventable disease. Isn't that the good news? It is a preventable. Preventable means what? Something can be done so we don't have to develop it, right? Okay? That's very good news. The report specifies recommendations based on solid evidence. And I want to emphasize this because I will not be sharing with you brain science here. I will be sharing with you very simple principles. But I want to stress the fact that according to the scientists who work on this document, these principles are based on what type of evidence, did they say? Solid evidence, right? Solid evidence, which when followed will be expected to reduce the incidence of cancer. Since we are late, I'm going to skip maybe a few slides and again go into just some of them or elaborate on some of them. Notice that in this graph they say that 1/3 of the most common cancers can actually be prevented. So out of the 600,000 or so people who die, you know, 1/3 of them didn't even have to develop cancer to begin with, according to this. And they actually came up with specific numbers and percentage for specific type of cancer. So when you look at the pink, for example, notice 1/3, exactly 1/3 or 76,000 plus cases of breast cancers, they don't have to develop to begin with if people follow these principles that I will outline to you. Notice when we look at right here, mouth, pharynx, and larynx cancer, as much as 63% of this cancer can be prevented. When we look at colorectal, which is another very common cancer, 50% of them, and endometrial cancer, very frequent cancer in females, almost 60% again of these cancers can be prevented. Yet, interestingly, I listed here some of the programs that we have here in the United States, in the United States, national programs that deal with cancer. And sadly, in this country, we don't have a single program, national program, that deals with cancer prevention. Because if we were to look at each individual programs that I listed here, you know what they deal with? They deal with screening, for example, and early detection. Now, if you are dealing with early detection, that means what? You can find out that you have already cancer, right? Today rather than 2 months from today. But you already have it. You see what I'm saying here? In fact, we have a new initiative. It's called the former vice president Joe Biden came up with this because his son died of brain cancer. And he says the goal is to get rid of cancer as we know it. But then when you listen to the details, they are talking about sharing data on cancer treatment and finding out about new agents to treat cancer. And again, the initiative is lacking what? Is lacking true prevention. Because when we are talking again about prevention, we are talking about what? Protecting ourselves, right? Protecting ourselves. I don't know if you have ever heard the story of this one particular village. There was this tiny village that was located on a hill. And everyone lived happily ever after, except for one thing. From time to time, they had a tragedy. because someone would fall down the cliff because of the location of this village. The village was on the hill and it was surrounded by very steep cliffs all around it. And so the people who lived there, they decided to do something about it. And they started putting pressure on the local politicians. And you know what the politicians came up with? They say, let's introduce a tax and we will collect money from the people. And from the money that we will collect, we are going to hire a nurse and build a little nursing station on the bottom of the hill. And the rationale was, as soon as someone falls down the hill, the nurse will be there with the first aid. You know? Everybody got excited and they collected the taxes and they built a little station and the nurse was there. And very soon they realized that they didn't prevent the problems from happening because people were falling down the cliff. And so the politicians got together and they came up with another idea and they said, oh, we just have to raise the taxes a little bit. And with the money that we are going to collect, we are going to buy an ambulance and hire a driver. And this time they thought, you are laughing. This time they thought, well, as soon as someone falls down the cliff, not only the nurse will be there, but that person right away will be taken to the local hospital with their own ambulance. And very soon they realized that they didn't solve the problem. And I don't know, it must have been an election year or something, because the politicians got together one more time and they were debating what solution they can come up with. So you know what the solution they came up with? They said, let's raise the taxes one more time. The politicians are good at that, right? But you know why they said that? They said, with the money that we are going to raise, we are going to build a hospital right on the bottom of the cliff. Of course, it's a fictional story, right? But, you know, in reality, even though we are laughing at the story, in reality, many people do exactly that. Many people do not do anything in terms of taking care of their own lives, health-wise. They just rely on what's waiting for them on the bottom of the hill. Are you with me what I'm saying here? You know? Now, let me ask you this question. Would you suggest a better solution to what these politicians came up with? What would be a better solution to prevent from the problem to happen in the first place? Build a fence, okay? Build a fence, right? And this is what this is about. The principles that I'm going to share with you, it's like building a fence. You know, if we build a fence, we will not be able to fall down the cliff because the fence will what? Will prevent us from falling down the cliff, right? But just like building a fence is something simple, these principles will be very simple. Building a hospital is not all that easy. In fact, I have a friend who worked at my university in the construction department. And then he quit his job and he was actually one of the supervisors when they were building a new hospital wing in my city. And he said that he had to actually go through a number of different trainings. And he was a professor at the university teaching construction, and yet he had to go through additional training because building a hospital was something different than building a school or building any other building. You see what I'm saying? So it's a little bit more sophisticated to build a hospital, right, than it is to build a fence. And yet we read that these principles are based on solid evidence, and so they will be actually effective in preventing us from falling down the cliff. And so here is the principles number one. And even though I don't have quotation marks here, these principles are all directly taken or quoted from this document that I showed you earlier. The first principle or recommendation deals with body fatness. Okay, body fatness. And this is what specifically it says in the document. Be as lean as possible within the normal range of body weight. Okay? Now, I don't want you to misunderstand this quote. They don't say we all are to be skinny and underweight, right? They say we are to be lean, but within a certain parameters of normal body weight, rather than being underweight or, you know, or looking skinny. And what they mean exactly is right here. I don't know if you have heard the term body mass index. Body mass index is sort of a proxy of our weight status. Okay, and if you have an internet, if you can go to Google, and if you type body mass index or body mass index calculator, okay, you will have many, many pages that you can click on, and all you will have to do is type your height and type your weight, and the body mass index, your own body mass index, will actually pop up. Okay, and to give you an example, my normal body mass index is about 23. Okay, 23. So that's still within this recommendation. Okay, now I have a brother who looks about two sizes of me. Okay, considerably larger, and I have never calculated his BMI or body mass index, but I would say maybe 35 or 38, you see? So again, it depends on the height. My brother is almost my height. And also it depends on the waist and how much extra pounds we may be carrying. I also, maybe before I go to that thought, notice that according to the American Institute for Cancer Research, maintaining a healthy weight is the single most important way to protect against cancer. So from all that you will hear tonight, this is the single most important principle that I hope you will remember, okay? And if you do calculate your body mass index, it turns out to be, you know, 30 or 35, or even, you know, slightly less than that, but not within that range, I hope you will be motivated to do something so you will actually get, you know, within that range, that narrow range, 21 to 23, because it will have a tremendous impact on your risk of cancer. Now, I'm giving you also here a formula in case you are not, you know, computer savvy and you don't go to any internet or Google or anything of that nature. It's actually very easy to calculate. You take your weight in pounds, multiply by 7 or 3, and then you take your height in inches squared. Okay, and that will give you the result. And here is actually my data here, not the picture, just the numbers. And so again, when you take the weight and the height and you put these into the formula, it's relatively easy to calculate that. Okay. By the way, I see you are taking notes, and I'm glad you do, but I can share these presentations with all of you, okay? In fact, the pastor already has a copy, but I can send the copies again to the pastor, and the pastor can forward it to you. And so if you would like to have, you know, these specific notes, you'll have the opportunity to receive them, okay? Now, here's an illustration why this principle is included in the cancer prevention guidelines, okay? So here we have a data in which the risk for specific type of cancers among people with two different BMI or body mass index categories were compared, okay? So notice in the title it says cancer mortality rates among men and women with BMI, that's body mass index, equal or above 35, that means they were obese, okay? Compared to BMI between 18.5 to 24.9. That means they were in what we call normal BMI category, okay? And so we have here on the left data for men, and this is a different type of cancers. And then here we have data for women, and again, different kinds type of cancers for women that were included in this particular study. These blue lines that you see, one blue line here and blue line here, indicate the risk for cancer for men and women in the normal BMI category. Okay? And then these dots that you see here, there's one, there's another, and there's another, and so on. And these numbers, and the same for women here, indicate the risk for women. Okay? And I need to teach you a simple principle in epidemiological studies, which is, this is an example of an epidemiological study, okay? In epidemiological studies, there are always at least two different groups to which data is compared. There's sometimes maybe three groups, four groups, five groups, 10 groups, and even more groups, depending on the study. And we select a reference group, and to the risk for the reference group, a risk for all the other groups is compared. Everyone with me? What I'm saying? Okay? So in this particular study, those with body mass index in the normal range category, 18.5 to 24.9, was the reference group. Okay? And every time we see numbers that are above one, that means higher risk in comparison to the reference group. And every time we see numbers that are less than one, that means lower or reduced risk in comparison to reference group. Okay? So specifically, to apply this, when we look at prostate cancer, notice here, okay, men in this BMI category, 35 or higher, had 1.35 times the risk of developing prostate cancer in comparison to the group represented by this blue line. Okay? And then when we look at, let me pick another very, common one, colon and rectum right here, okay? Colon and rectum, notice 1.84 times the risk. That means 84% higher risk for men in the obese BMI category in comparison to the normal BMI category, okay? Let me give you an example here for women. Notice we have breast cancer right here, okay? Breast cancer right here. And we have 2.12 times the risk in comparison to group represented by this blue line, which are women in the normal BMI category, okay? So 2.12 means 112 times percent higher risk. Everyone with me? Okay? And so I want you to notice that regardless of which cancer we are talking about here, regardless of whether we are talking men or women, those in the obese BMI category had what? Had a higher risk in comparison to the other group, which were men and women in the normal BMI category. And that's why they say this is the single most important factor. Okay? Let's look at the second one, physical activity. Physical activity, and they say, be physically active as part of everyday life. Now, I underline that everyday word, but this is a quote from this document. Every day, we are supposed to have some type of activity, physical activity, on a daily basis. Further, they say, be moderately physically active, equivalent to brisk walking for at least 30 minutes every day. And then as fitness improves, aim for 60 minutes or more of moderate or 30 or more of vigorous physical activity every day. Okay? That's the recommendation. That's the expert recommendation. Now, I don't know about you, but I absolutely love to play tennis. And I play tennis very often, and I am usually when, you know, we usually play, whoever wins two sets wins the match, right? And sometimes it happens that, you know, say me and my partner, if we play, say, doubles, we win 2-0 or 2-1, or we lose 1-2 or 0-2. And if we win the first set and lose the next, then obviously we play the third set, right, for the winner. But if one, whether me and my partner or the other two, win two straight, then the match is over. And guess what? I am usually the first to say, hey, let's play the third one. Regardless of that the match is over already, right? Let's play one more because I absolutely love it, you know? So I have a, in fact, I usually play tennis on Sunday at 1 o'clock, and because I'm here until Sunday morning, I will not be able to make it, so I postponed it until 3 o'clock, and I should be able to make it at 3 o'clock on Sunday. And then I have a match on Monday at 3 o'clock, and on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, and on Thursday at 3 o'clock. And the only reason I don't have tennis match on Tuesday is because I play ping pong on Tuesday. I play ping pong on Tuesday at 7, so I go and play, and it's usually about an hour and a half of ping pong. So the only time I don't play is Friday and Saturday, although occasionally I may also play on Friday if, let's say, the weather was not good on, you know, Wednesday or Thursday, one of these days. I may still play early afternoon on Sunday. And so the key, I will skip some of the specific data here, but the key here is to find something that we absolutely love to do, okay? And I would like to encourage you, I don't know, I'm assuming some of you are part of this church, and even if you are not, I would like to encourage you to stay in touch and call each other and motivate each other in terms of getting out and doing some type of activity, whatever that may be, okay? Because, you know, oftentimes with physical activity, it's like with New Year's resolutions. You know, people make New Year's resolutions, that's at toward the end of December, and by the end of January, about this time that we are in now, they have a hard time remembering what those resolutions were, you know what I'm saying? But if you are part of the group, see, I am part of a Baywood Racquet Club, about 200 players. Not all of them are on my level, some are better, some are not as good. But I have a group of about 12 to 15, and if I don't call them, they call me. And so it's a motivation, and you know, that way, if we don't feel like going for a walk or doing whatever the physical activity type may be, then you can get a call from someone else, and that person will motivate you and will go. So this is very important, really, to start doing something and sustain it over a period of time if we are not doing this already. And the benefits, trust me, go way beyond just cancer prevention. We could go, in fact, I have written stuff about the benefits of physical activity, and it's really mind-boggling how much we can achieve if we implement very little in terms of physical activity, you know, half an hour to an hour, or maybe just a little bit longer per day. Recommendation number 3, and again, I took this from the document. The document says sugary drinks, but when they elaborated on this recommendation, they don't just talk about drinks. They also talk about sugary foods, okay? In fact, notice, limit consumptions of energy-dense foods, and then avoid sugary drinks. And then they give some more specifics. It's interesting that they actually pointed out the fast foods, you know. Now, when we talk about sugary drinks / foods, what are we talking about? Can you give me an example? What are we talking about? Soda, okay, very good. That's a good example, especially when it's regular, right? That's definitely, there is about 8 to 12 teaspoons of sugar, depending on which type we buy, okay? That's the best example. In fact, 33% of all the calories that people ingest come from sodas, okay? So that's a lot of calories that people ingest from that, okay? Anything else come to mind? Sorry? Pastries, very good, okay? The cookies and pies and cakes and things of that nature, okay? Very good, okay? And, you know, there are a number of others. I'm going to give you one that sometimes I see in some churches as part of their potluck. Can you think of what I'm thinking of? Fruit punch? Does this ring a bell? Okay? I want you to understand that there is actually a difference between 100% fruit juice versus a fruit punch or fruit cocktail or something to that effect, okay? Maybe not as much in terms of the caloric content, but the fruit juices have what? Have a variety of compounds that God created or God put in them when He created our planet here. Something that we don't have in a fruit punch. Because what's a fruit punch? A fruit punch has very few ingredients. Water, sugar or sweetener, right? Coloring agent and flavoring agent. And that's about it. And that's what's being served oftentimes in different churches for potluck, okay? So one good policy in some of the churches I worked with in the past, we implemented a policy that when we have a potluck, we serve nothing but water, okay? Well, maybe you can serve, you know, herbal tea or something, or there are other options, okay? But the sugary drinks, it's just not a very good idea. And I can tell you, in fact, I want you to see this. This is a quote again from the American Institute for Cancer Research. Choosing healthy foods and drinks can help us avoid overweight and obesity and therefore reduce our cancer risk. Okay, so that's the main reason why they put this recommendation here. But notice the rest of this quote. Water is the best alternative. Okay, water is the best alternative. And I will tell you, I moved so many times in my life. When I moved to the United States, which was in 99, I moved to Michigan. I lived in Michigan for 1 year. And then I moved to Alabama, and I spent 7 months in Alabama. And then I moved to Mississippi, and I spent a little bit over 2 years in there. And the last 14 years or so in North Carolina. But you know what I noticed? Every time I moved, I noticed the water tasted somewhat different. You know, the water has actually taste. We can actually develop the taste, and then you will see if you are not home, if you are traveling or whatever, and you buy bottled water, it actually tastes differently. So we can actually develop our taste buds to like water, and we would not want to drink anything else, or for sure we would not want to drink sugary beverages, okay? Let's move into the fourth one. Eat mostly plant foods. Okay? Again, I underline the word mostly, but that's what these experts recommend. Eat mostly plant foods. Notice they say eat a variety of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes or beans. And then population average consumption of non-starchy vegetables and of fruits should be at least 600 grams or 21 ounces. We don't really have to measure or remember, you know, exactly. The point is what? The emphasis is on what? The emphasis is on plant foods. In fact, I wonder whether you have seen the newest recommendations, dietary recommendations, the pictorial recommendations that we used to use the pyramid, right, to teach about, you know, what's a healthy diet. Now what do we use? Do you remember?
My plate,
okay? And when we look at my plate, what does the my plate look like in terms of what should be on the plate? The bulk of what should be on the plate is what? Plant foods, right? Fruits, vegetables, grains, you know, beans and so on, okay? And so this is very consistent with that. And then further notice, consume relatively unprocessed cereal or grain and or pulses, which are legumes, and other foods that are a natural source of dietary fiber. One of the reasons they included fiber here is because fiber is helpful in prevention of colorectal cancer, for example. But these foods are helpful in prevention of a variety of cancers. I'm going to show you some data in a second. Notice, plant foods bolster our body's defenses against cancer. So again, I have actually a number of different studies included. I may not show you all of them, but I'll give you some examples. This is fruit, vegetable, and colon cancer risk in 14 different studies. And they are listed here. And I know at least some of you, maybe I'm not sure if all of you, but some of you are members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, correct? And notice that some of those studies that were included were actually
the Adventists have study here, okay? And so the Seventh-day Adventist studies were included here also. Adventist health study for women and for men data were included. What they found was that in comparison to people with the lowest intake of fruits and vegetables, those with the highest intake had 9% lower risk of colon cancer. Okay, 9% lower risk for this particular analysis. Here we have another analysis. And here we actually have a different comparison. So notice on the left-hand side we have total fruit and vegetable, and then total vegetable, yellow, orange vegetable, total fruit, and citrus fruit. And we have a comparison of those with the highest versus those with the lowest intake. So in blue, light blue, and the bar with one, that's representing the risk for those with the lowest intake, okay? That's the risk for bladder cancer among women, okay? And then the yellow bar represents the risk for those with the highest intake of fruits and vegetables. So when we look at total fruit and vegetable intake, notice the difference is what? 0.65, which translates to 65% lower risk, okay? Those with the highest intake of fruits and vegetables in comparison to those with the lowest intakes had 65% lower risk of bladder cancer here. And so we could go into the details here, but you see yourselves the number, okay? Again, remember in epidemiological studies, every time you see a number that is lower than that one, that means in comparison to the reference group, the risk is reduced, right? It's just a matter of how much, whether it was 50%, 20%, whatever. And you can see these numbers correspond with specific reduction in the risk, okay? Here we have another study. Citrus fruit intake, that's oranges and limes and grapefruits and things of that nature, right? And breast cancer risk. And again, we have a comparison, those with the highest intake versus those with the lowest intake. The difference was 10%, 0.9, that means 10% lower risk among those with the highest intake of these fruits. And then here we have fruits and vegetables and endometrial cancer risk. And that's a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is always based on several different studies. And so if we were to look at this data, this is one study, this is another study, this is yet another, yet another, yet another, and so on. And so here we have the comparison. Here is the overall lesson that we can take from this. And the overall lesson is that those with the highest intake of fruits and vegetables had 0.71 the risk, which means 29% lower risk, okay, in developing endometrial cancer in comparison to those with the lowest intake, okay? And so we can see here that study after study, we have benefits shown for intake of fruits and vegetables. Here we have another study, lycopene or tomato intake. Lycopene is a specific compound that is found in tomatoes. In fact, tomato paste is the richest of this particular compound. And this compound, among other cancers, is helpful in prostate cancer prevention. Okay? And so again, notice, compared with consumers with lower raw tomato intake, the odds ratio of incidence of prostate cancer among consumers of higher raw tomato intake was 0.89, which means 19% lower. Okay? And then for consumers of higher level of cooked tomato intake, this odds ratio was 0.85, which means 15% lower. So whether we are talking raw, whether we are talking cooked, right? Regardless, okay? Tomatoes seem to be helpful in prevention of cancer. Here's another data, and I want to ask you, when...
What about watermelon? It also has the same in it.
Okay, so Lycopene is found in a variety of different foods that are pink or deep green in color. Okay, so this was just an example with tomatoes, because tomato paste really is the richest. But anything that contains lycopene would have similar preventive effect. It's just a matter of to what degree. You know, people who would be eating a lot of watermelon and maybe less tomatoes would benefit more from watermelon than from tomatoes. You see what I'm saying? But regardless, the idea is here that this specific compound, lycopene, is preventive for prostate cancer. But not only for prostate cancer. It is preventive for colorectal cancer, for example, also. It has, you know, other beneficial impact. Okay? Notice, this is skin cancer. And here's my question. You know, I was just in Peru over Christmas, New Year's break. And when I was in Peru, I asked myself a question. What's the rate of skin cancer in Peru? And I asked this question because in Peru, just like in other places in South America, when you are in relatively high elevation, the sun is so intense. I mean, you can get burned in 10, 15 minutes, you know? And I wondered, you know, what's the rate? So I looked up data on rate of skin cancer by country. And you know which countries had the highest rates of skin cancer? New Zealand, Australia, European countries, US and Canada. You know? And I'm like, how is that? I remember I was in Rio de Janeiro in July, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in July. That was in 2010. Now, July is winter in Rio de Janeiro. You know, it was 82 degrees one day, and the next day it was 81 degrees. And I'm like, how hot does it get here in the summer? And they said, well, 100, 105, you know. But the point is what? They have the sun exposure all the time, because even in the winter time it's hot and the sun is very intense. And if you look at the data, you know, those in New Zealand and those in northern areas of Europe and US had, you know, 7.1 of whatever, you know, by whatever. And in Peru it was 2.1, and in other South American countries it was even lower sometimes, you know. And we are told, sun exposure, sun exposure, sun exposure. And I'm not denying, I'm not saying that that's not true. I mean, if we are long enough exposed to the sun, the skin may have higher risk for skin cancer. But the point I'm trying to make is that you can go to CDC website, Center for Disease Control and Prevention. You can go to National Institutes of Health website. I don't care where you go. You can go to the National Cancer Institute website, and you will not learn about dietary impact on skin cancer. You know, you will learn about having white skin and sun exposure, but not dietary. Yet we have studies. This is just one example that show that what we eat impacts our risk of skin cancer. You can see here, this is green leafy vegetables, and comparison among those with the lowest intake, represented by this bar graph, and then those with the higher and the highest intake here. And those with the highest intake had about 40% lower risk in comparison to those with the lowest intake. Yes, sir?
Do you think cancer is actually on the rise, or is the medical community with modern medicine just getting better at diagnosing it?
It's a good question. Actually, depending on which type of cancer we are talking about, okay? Now, if we combine the numbers all together, up until about 2010, 2012, I think, somewhere in there, the cancer rates were slightly on the rise since at least 1960s. And then since that time, they leveled off or declined somewhat, okay? And also, it depends on who exactly we are talking about. So, for example, if you go to California, in California, they actually have a steady decline over a longer period of time. If you look at North or South Carolina, it's actually on the rise regardless of the national data, okay? And it's my theory only, I don't know whether it's true or not, but where do you find the most health nuts in this country? It's in California. So it may be, I don't know for sure, but it might be because California actually put a lot of emphasis on healthy eating. In fact, I had a girlfriend once in California and I went to visit her. And guess what? We went to like place like kind of like McDonald's that was on the corner of the street where you could buy a vegan fast food that you just ordered and less than a minute you had the food, you know? That was in California, okay? You have governmental policies that are user-friendly in terms of preventing people from developing certain health conditions. Like, for example, you may recall Governor Schwarzenegger banned all trans fats in California, you know? Sometimes when I teach in a classroom, I tell my students, why can't we do it in North Carolina? And I make a point because I don't know where these students will end up. Maybe one of these days, one of them will be, you know, a public health director or something, right? Or even a governor or something, right? Because, you know, the politicians do stupid things. That example I gave you earlier with the building the nursing station and hospital, just one example. But here's another. I am a state employee. I work at the state university. And, you know, gradually over time, they do what? They increase the premium. They increase the deductible, the copays, you know. And what they do is they limit access to care for people because now they have to spend more money, right? They take people out of our pockets, and that's all that boils down to. If they just sign things like no trans fats, yeah, right? Or let's implement taxes on these sugary foods. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. With a stroke of a pen, they would save money, me, yeah, and others, state employees and others who benefit from the insurance companies. And guess what? They would improve overall health because just by the sheer fact that there are no foods that contain this detrimental compound called trans fatty acids, we would not ingest it. You know what I'm saying? Regardless of our food choices, you know? So,
South Carolina, when we moved here, if you had like anything like only 10% of, and the rest was water and so on,
mm-hmm,
we did have taxes. I happen to have a gallon jug that has all these 1% things all over. They took it out.
Mm-hmm. Sadly, yes. And I think, in honesty, we will not have time this time. Maybe next time, sometimes. But you know, one of the things I teach at the university is dementia and Alzheimer's disease prevention. And I tell students, we look at projection data in terms of how many people will develop the disease and how much it will cost and things of that nature. And I tell them, we have absolutely no choice. This nation has no choice but to change the way we do business, to change the way we eat and change, you know, we take care of our health, because the projection data is such that there is absolutely impossible to pay for the health expenditure related just to Alzheimer's disease in just a few next decades, you know? So we will have no choice but to make certain changes. Let me go back to this one. The take-home message is what? Eat your fruits and veggies, big time, right? But when we say fruits and veggies, what comes to mind automatically? Are they not contaminated? Are they all not contaminated? Okay? So let me show you an example here. This is actually a European study, European Food Safety Authority study. They evaluated 11 or 12,000 food samples for some contaminants. This is the data for PCBs. These are detrimental compounds that we don't want to ingest. And notice what they found. What was the most contaminated of all the food samples that they tested? Fish, and then eggs, and then milk and dairy, and then meat from ruminants like cows and stuff. and then meat from poultry. And what was the least contaminated? In comparison to all the other foods, the contamination of fruits and veggies and cereal, which means grains, was basically negligible. You see? So, you know, if you get excited about some of this and you start sharing with friends and they tell you, well, are they not contaminated? If they are concerned about contamination, what should they be ingesting? They should be ingesting the fruits and veggies and grains and so on. You know, in nutritional science, we talk about something called bioaccumulation. You may have heard the term before. Bioaccumulation means basically a little fish eats some, you know, seaweeds, right? And a bigger fish comes along and does what? Eats the little fish, right? And then a bigger fish eats that fish and so on. And we have what? The little contamination that the little fish had was transferred to the bigger fish. And then the contamination from that fish was transferred to that bigger fish he had and so on. And the question is this, and I want you to think about this one. Who is the very last in the food chain?
Yeah.
You see? We are the very last ones. We are the ones that benefit from all these contaminants, you know? One of the classes I teach is called life cycle nutrition. And that means that we talk about pregnancy and issues related, you know, to that period of time. And we end up talking about centenarians or those who live past the 100 years. And right now we are still talking about pregnancy. And we just talked this week about certain fats that are important for proper fetal development. And so, you know, these fats are among other sources found in fish. And so I shared with them that the recommendation for pregnant women to eat fish is no more than 12 ounces total per week and no more than twice per week, right? So say you have a little bit, say 6 ounces on Tuesday and you have, say, 6 ounces on Friday and that's it. Why? Because of the contaminants, right? Because of the contaminants, because it can actually harm the fetus, right? But there are other contaminants that may be more important for all the adults and so on, you know? And so in order to reduce the intake of contaminants, what do we need to focus on based on the research, right? We need to focus on the plant foods rather than animal foods, okay? Now, I noticed that the recommendation also dealt with cereal or grain, right? So here is a quote that tells us the impact of fiber and grains on neck cancer. Notice women with higher intake of total fiber and total grain had a lower risk of head and neck cancer, 0.77. That means 23% lower risk, okay? And so on. I will not read perhaps the whole thing here, but the point is here, you know, grains and fiber decreases the risk. Here's another study. Intake of whole grains and risk of endometrial cancer, okay? So we have here, notice, 5 groups, right? Group 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And these groups are based on the intake, serving per week, of whole grains. From group with the lowest, higher, 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 until the highest. And we have very interesting pattern. The higher the intake of whole grains, the lower there is. Notice that the numbers are decreasing, right? The lower the number, the lower the risk, okay? And so, just like it was the case with fruits, and again, for the sake of time, I may not elaborate on everything here, but just it was the case for fruits, whether we are talking grains or whether we are talking specific veggies such as legumes, for example, here's an example of soya, we see that these foods are beneficial in terms of decreasing cancer risk, okay? Maybe I spend a minute on this one because people oftentimes ask, can I have soya beans or soya bean products in terms of, or when I already have cancer, okay? And the answer is yes, okay? up until about 5-6 years ago, the American Institute of Cancer Research stated that for cancer prevention, soya products are absolutely fine. Okay? But once you develop cancer, you should limit it. But they changed their view based on available research, based on new research. And now they say whether you are ingesting soya products to prevent cancer or whether you already have it, you can have in both cases. Okay? In fact, if anything, this research shows notice that soya was associated with reduced mortality among people who already had cancer and reduced reoccurrence. Okay? So it can help with survival and it may help in prevention of developing new type of cancer. So soya is absolutely recommended for cancer prevention. And then we have another fifth recommendation that deals with animal foods. And it states the following: limit intake of red meat and avoid processed meat. Okay? Notice red meat and processed meat. Okay? What are we talking about here? Okay? So we have five types of red meats. Red meat include things like beef, okay, and pork, and mutton or lamb meat, okay, goat meat, and horse meat. And yes, although we may not eat meat here, but in some countries in Europe, for example, meat is actually considered like a specialty type of food. You go to Italy, for example, and horses are shipped from all over Europe to Italy because Italians love horse meat, you know. When it comes to processed meat basically means the meat has been treated with some agents to preserve it for a longer period of time. So whether it was a specific type of chemicals or even salt, okay, to cure it for a little bit longer period of time. That's what that means. And notice that these words have specific meaning. So they say limit intake of red meat, but then they say what? Avoid processed meat. So which of the two are the most detrimental? The processed meats, right? The processed meats here would be the most detrimental. By the way, practically speaking, any type of burger, sausages, things of that nature would be in that second category, okay? And then notice how much they allow these scientists say how much may be okay. Population average consumption of red meat to be no more than 300 grams or 11 ounces per what?
Per
week, you know? Not per day. I remember this reaction. I had series of lectures once in one of the biggest churches in my town. It was a Baptist, predominantly African-American church. There was about 300 people in the audience. And I showed them this recommendation. It became very silent, you know, in the church, you know. It's like, how we can handle that one, right? But, you know, number one, I didn't come up with it, okay? I'm just communicating to you what the best experts in the world came up with here, okay? And number two, and I would encourage you to organize a cooking school and, you know, try to learn how to do some alternative cooking. I remember I participated in a vegetarian, in fact, it was called International Vegetarian Nutrition Congress. And the dean of the School of Public Health had his remarks to open the Congress for business. And he got up and he said something to the effect, "I am so mad at you." And, you know, he got everyone's attention, like, what? He's supposed to give some, you know, welcoming remarks. And he's saying, "I'm so mad at you." And then as he elaborated on what he was saying, he basically said that you know, he just became a vegetarian just a few months ago. And for all of this time, he really didn't consider becoming a vegetarian because no one really encouraged him to do so. And you, and he referred to some of the local people, you know, who were vegetarians, and some of the organizers of the Congress who were vegetarian for a long period of time. Said, I'm mad at you because, number one, the food tastes great. Number two, we had such a wonderful time getting together and cooking together and learning some of the alternatives way of cooking. And number three, I feel so much better in terms of my health and I lost some weight, you know. And so this may be your experience. I would strongly encourage you to have maybe, I don't know, once a month, twice a month, maybe weekly, depending on, you know, the church situation. Learn church recipes and it will not be something that you will not have the same reaction as some people have, which is, what am I going to eat, you know, if I implement this principle. And I want to show you why this recommendation. So this is an analysis of data based on a number of different studies. And what they basically showed here is that in comparison to people with the lowest red meat intake, those with the highest red meat intake had 45%, notice 1.45, that means 45% higher risk of gastric cancer. Okay? 45% higher risk of gastric cancer. Okay? And here we have specifically beef intake and gastric cancer. And again, it's a comparison of those with the highest to those with the lowest intake. And what was the difference? 1.44. Do you see that here? 1.44, okay? That's the difference. That means 44% higher risk for those with the highest beef intake, okay? Here we have dose response per 100 grams per day. Per day intake of red meat. Now, I know we are not familiar in the U.S. with grams, right? 100 grams, that's 3.5 ounces, okay? Very small amount. Okay, so it's a comparison for every 3.5 ounces, okay, intake of red meat, notice, there is a 27% higher risk for colorectal adenomas. That's not yet cancer, but like a precancerous condition. Okay, and here we have per 50 grams of processed meat, that's a little bit more than 1.5 ounces. That's almost negligible, it would seem, but notice the difference. 1.29% higher risk for processed meat, which shows again that processed meat is actually more detrimental. Okay? I'm going to, again, for the sake of time, I'm going to go further. The idea here, we could go over every single of these slides, every single of this data, we'll see the same pattern. Those with the highest intake, regardless of which type of meat, whether we are talking red meat or processed meat, okay, have a higher risk in comparison to those with the lowest. Okay?
Ever do anything in the difference between red meat as it usually is here in the United States versus those of us who buy meat that is organically grown? Have they made any of that kind of
I don't believe so. Now, in these type of studies, they take the type of meat that people typically eat, okay? And that goes for fruits, nuts, anything, okay? So sometimes when I share data on nuts, for example, people ask, is it the salted nuts, roasted nuts, what nuts? It's the type of nuts that people typically eat that includes all of the above, you know. Yes, sir?
So like in my case, I love a good steak. But if you were going to get off of the red meat, are you able to get the same good things out of that meat?
Okay.
And other plants?
Okay, very good question. Not only you would, because the main benefit from a meat intake would be iron, okay? So if you compare, for example, iron deficiency among vegetarians versus non-vegetarians. Vegetarians have higher risk because meat has heme iron, which is easier for us to absorb. Okay, but you will get the same benefit whether we are talking red meat, processed meat, poultry, or fish even. You will have the same benefit. In fact, if you were to switch to what we call low mercury, high of fatty fish, for example, you will also get extra benefit from the what we call fish oil. So the for people who don't want to become vegetarians, the preferable meat type would be fish. Okay, although that would not mean eating fish every day because of the, there are some contamination. Okay, but replacement of the processed or red meat, the best way to do it would be with fish and poultry. Poultry, which means chicken or turkey, for example, would also be. Now, you will still have the same issues in terms of production of these, or how can I put it? The way these animals are kept and what they are given to eat in order to produce that meat. You see what I'm saying? Because unfortunately, 95% plus of the meat that we have in grocery store is being raised in what we call a factory-like type of conditions, okay? So you have the same issues, but in terms of the good thing that we may actually get from meat in terms of the iron intake and absorption, you will get the same benefit, yes. Let me show you this data, and then we'll move on to the next recommendation. Notice here, this is data from Korea and Japan. And this is a period of a time from 1950 to 2000 plus for cereal intake. And notice that it declined over that period of time in both Korea and Japan. In the same time, here we have data for meat, also in the same period of time. And notice that meat intake increased in the same period of time. Okay? And then let's look at the data on the right-hand side here. Again, this is meat and cereal consumption and colorectal cancer. So this incidence here show the rate of colorectal cancer over a period of time here. And notice what do we see? We see a steady increase, just like we see a steady increase for meat consumption. In fact, not only that, but I want you to notice an interesting nuance in here. Because somewhere here, we actually see slight reduction in meat consumption. Okay? And notice how nicely it corresponds with this data here. Okay? Now, if there is any proof that one would want to look at, it doesn't get any more closer than what you see on this particular thing, right? As the cereal intake decline and meat intake increase, proportionally to that meat intake, we see what? Colorectal cancer rates increase, okay? But again, we see that, you know, regardless of which type of cancer we look at, okay? Let's look at recommendation number 6. It deals with alcohol intake. And basically it states the following. From the point of view of cancer prevention, the best level of alcohol consumption is zero. Okay? And this is oftentimes a surprise for people. Because people are sometimes being told, in the media especially, that a little bit of red wine may be fine because it may actually help you to reduce the risk for your heart disease, right? Or heart attack, you know? See, when I teach people, when I teach students in my classes, I try very hard to make sure that they remember one specific principle. And the principle goes like this. Do no harm. And what I mean by that is, when advising clients or patients, we are to look comprehensively at the impact of dietary factors on diseases, not just one health condition. You see what I'm saying here? So if we tell a client, oh, have, you know, a glass of red wine every day or every other day to reduce the risk for heart disease, the question is, what about cancer? You see what I'm saying here? So we have to look at what factors might be actually helpful for prevention, both cardiovascular disease and cancer risk, and choose from that. By the way, the American Heart Association does not recommend alcohol intake or red wine for heart disease prevention. Okay? Interestingly. So there are some individuals, you know, oftentimes physicians who are hired by certain news organizations that promote this, but this is not done by, you know, a professional organization such as the American Heart Association. The evidence that all types of alcoholic drinks increase the risk of a number of cancers is now stronger than it was in the 1990s. And here's an example. Notice here we have a risk for a variety of different cancers. Notice we have breast, liver, rectum, and so on, other ones, right? And this is based on 25 grams of alcohol intake per day, 50 and 100. So this is a comparison to people who never drink any alcohol. I don't drink alcohol. So if someone would drink 25 grams per day, that person would be compared to me, let's say, okay? And so when we look at specifically oral cavity and pharynx cancer, 86% higher risk for those with this intake of cancer, of alcohol, in comparison to those who don't drink at all. And so on. I know you can see these numbers. These numbers indicate, again, a higher risk in comparison to those who don't drink. Pastor?
Dr. Roman, 25 grams is what, like a beer, like a 1 ounce?
Okay, so in one beer, you would have roughly about 14 grams of alcohol, pure alcohol. Okay,
okay, so 25 would be kind of like...
So it would be a little, not quite two cans.
2 beers, right.
Yeah.
Daily. Mm-hmm.
Daily, exactly.
So that would be an increase of 86%.
Yeah. But this doesn't mean that this one can would not be detrimental. It just means that for this particular analysis, they selected these groups, 25, 50, and 100. You see? It doesn't mean that it doesn't increase. Because what do we know alcohol does? You know, we have these sanitizers, right? Oftentimes even in churches and in other places, and we just put a little bit of it on our hand, right? And, you know, rub it. And apparently 99% of the germs are destroyed. And guess what? It's true. Now, how is it? Because of the alcohol content. Because what does alcohol do? Alcohol dissolves the membrane, okay? The membrane. And when you dissolve the membrane of the germ, the germ dies. But the same goes when we ingest alcohol. When we ingest alcohol, alcohol is going to dissolve the membrane of the cell, you see? So it dissolves, it kills cell membranes, therefore it kills cells. And then the body is trying to what? Regenerate that cells. And it's a constant process of killing or dissolving and regenerating. And eventually the DNA goes without any control, and that's what we are talking about, you know, cancer development. Recommendation number 7, it deals with salt intake. And you can see the specific recommendation here. And I will tell you that salt or sodium, because salt by weight is 40% sodium and 60% chloride. Okay? So when we are talking about the recommendation, which is here, that we should not ingest 5 grams of salt, which is roughly a teaspoon. Okay? So we should not ingest more than a teaspoon per day. Okay? That would translate to 2 grams or 40% of that as sodium. Now, for a comparison, an average intake in the United States is about 4,200. It's a little bit over 4,200 in comparison to 2 grams here. So 4,200, that means 4.2 grams, okay? So the average intake is about more than twice the recommended intake here, okay? So we have ways to cut the salt intake on. And you know, every time I teach about salt, you know what people think of? What do people think of? People think of a salt shaker, okay? And the reality is that whatever we get from a salt shaker, it's negligible, you know? I am Polish originally, and that means I love sandwiches. And so I may have, you know, avocado and maybe fried tofu and slices of tomatoes, and then I'm going to put a little bit of salt on it. That's negligible. You know where we get most salt from? Processed foods, the stuff we buy already in grocery stores that is prepared in cans, for example, in frozen entrees, in restaurants and things of that nature. Some ethnic foods, even bread. I don't know why I make my own bread, and honestly, I don't put any salt in my bread. None. But even in a bread, if you go to a grocery store next time you buy bread, look how much sodium is in that bread per serving, because that's the information you will see on the label. And you will see that some of the bread per serving, you will get 300 milligrams, okay, of sodium per slice of bread. So let's say you have five in a day, that's 1,500, right? If you are Polish like myself, you will have more than five. That means you can meet this recommendation or exceed this recommendation just by eating bread. You see? So it is a good idea, and we don't have to do it every time we go to a grocery store, but every time I buy something new or I am interested in a new product in a grocery store, I do look at the food label. And not necessarily at the front of the package, but the back of the package. The nutritional content or nutritional facts and ingredients. You know, and I remember when for the first time I saw Nutella. Are you familiar with Nutella?
Yes.
Nutella in the United States. I saw Nutella many, many, many years ago back in Poland where I grew up. Because Nutella is a German product and we got a lot of products in Poland from Germany. So when I saw Nutella, I put it into my grocery cart and I was like, wow, it's been so many years. And then I'm thinking, oh, wait a second, I'm a health nut now. I never used to be. Let me see what's in it. So I looked and I started reading. I'm like, I think I'm going to make my own, you know? So I put it back on the shelf. But it reminded me, not only it reminded me of Nutella, but it reminded me the taste of Nutella, because I remember eating this, right? And guess what? I went home and I make my own. And I can very easily make Nutella-like type of stuff, whether from nuts or seeds or combination of it, you know? So oftentimes we can make our own alternative that is better than what is available in a grocery store. The last recommendation, dietary supplements. The last recommendation is oftentimes the most surprising. And this is what it says. Aim to meet dietary needs through diet alone. And further, dietary supplements are not recommended for cancer prevention. Okay? And that's a surprise oftentimes because many people who take supplements do them exactly for prevention of chronic health conditions such as cancer and cardiovascular disease. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong. I actually have a series of lectures on dietary supplements, and I discuss dietary supplements that we should not be taking because if anything, they may be actually detrimental, okay? But I also have a few lectures in which I recommend certain dietary supplements. In fact, tomorrow afternoon when we discuss other issues, I'm going to mention some that I would recommend that you take. And in fact, I take them myself. So depending on which one we are talking about, they may be detrimental, they may be neutral, or they may be beneficial. But this recommendation is given in the context of what? Cancer prevention, okay? And when we look at what supplements are being taken for cancer prevention, they include stuff like vitamin C and vitamin E and beta carotene. And guess what? Studies have shown that if some of these supplements might actually decrease risk for one type of cancer, they in the same time may increase risk for another type of cancer. And that's why we have this recommendation. Let me show you. This is vitamin E and C in prevention of prostate and total cancer in men. So this was done with more than 14,000 male physicians who are 50 or older. Okay? And they identified, notice, more than 1,000 prostate cancers, almost 2,000 total cancers. Okay? And notice what they found. Here's the results. Okay? So the we have darker blue and lighter blue. The one represents the risk for those who receive one type of vitamin supplement, whether vitamin E, say, and the other vitamin C. And notice, I'm going to just give you one example. Let's say, let's take this one here, colorectal. Okay? Notice that this darker blue bar graph shows 0.68, which translates to 32% lower risk, okay, for this particular cancer. But then when we look at this graph here, notice this is 1.2. That means 20% higher risk for pancreatic cancer. So the same type of supplement reduced the risk for one type of cancer, increased the risk for another. You see what I'm saying here? Okay, and that's why we have the recommendation that these supplements should not be recommended. Notice in this large long-term trial of Mayo physicians, neither vitamin C, E, or C supplements reduce the risk of prostate or total cancer. These data provide no support for the use of these supplements for the prevention of cancer in middle-aged and older men. Here's another one, and I will just show you here a conclusion. Dietary supplementation with vitamin E significantly did what? Increase the risk of prostate cancer among healthy men. So they are not necessarily benign. They may actually be harmful. Okay, that's what this shows. Okay, and so, again, the conclusion from this study, the lack of benefit from dietary supplementation with vitamin E or other agents with respect to preventing common health conditions and cancers or improving overall survival and their potential harm underscore the need for consumers to be skeptical of health claims for unregulated over-the-counter products in the absence of strong evidence of benefit demonstrated in clinical trials. Okay? We have to remember that the supplemental industry is a $27 or $28 billion industry. And every time we buy one, they benefit from it, okay? And as I mentioned, there are supplements that actually may be beneficial. And I take some supplements myself. But you know how many supplements are available in our grocery stores, pharmacies, and supplemental stores? How many would you say? How many supplements? Hundreds? Thousands. There are more than 75,000 different type of supplements available. And as far as the supplemental business is concerned, all of us should be taking all of them. You see what I'm saying here? So we have to be wise and choose those who that actually may be benefits. Okay? I want to finish by reading this quote here. This is editorial from a scientific journal. Almost every time we take a hard look at objective evidence regarding nutritional supplements, the balance tips away from benefit and toward harm. Over the past two decades, we have been repeatedly disappointed in the ability of vitamin supplements to reduce risk for cancers at several sites, including the stomach, colorectum, breast, and lung. Notice, foods that are rich in vitamins seem to be associated with reduced risk of cancer, but vitamins packaged in as pills clearly do not have the same effect. And really, honestly, I could not have stated better myself. That's what we see, not in dozens, but in hundreds, if not thousands of different scientific publications. And so we need to focus on real foods, stuff that God created and we can utilize. And you know, in the when we read the Bible, do you realize that the Bible mentioned a cook and the Bible mentioned a recipe? I'll give you a simple example. Have you ever heard of Ezekiel 4:9? That's a recipe for bread that is found in the Bible, right? And the Bible talks about a variety of different fruits and vegetables that were intended for our health, right? Tomorrow, I will be discussing heart disease and diabetes, and I will also again mention in the context of these health conditions some supplements that actually may be beneficial, okay? And so I hope you will come back and invite others if you can. If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer.
When you were talking about grains, soy, corn, and wheat are all primarily genetically modified now. And this is why wheat came off of the pyramid. You know, I buy very little bread, and I have purchased almond flour and coconut flour to make my own.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Well, when it comes to soy, most soybean is genetically modified, you're right. But the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, according to the law that governs the production and consumption of foods, states that if a product is labeled organic, it cannot be genetically modified.
That's true.
So when I go to buy soybeans, I choose the organic soybeans. And not often I buy ready-made soya products. I may buy occasionally what we call the soya meat substitutes, but I actually prefer to cook my own soya and incorporate it into burgers and other things. When I buy tofu, for example, or tempeh or anything else of that type, I buy the organic type. So we don't have to buy the genetically modified if we are concerned with that, right? In terms of wheat has not been dropped from the pyramid or from the recommendations, okay? And I'm not saying wheat is not modified, but it has not been genetically modified as in men manipulating the gene. Wheat has been modified in the process of, I'm not sure if that's a technical term, but sort of a natural selection to yield a product hybrid type of thing, to yield a product that has more protein and specifically gluten. But that's not the, for the lack of a better word, artificial type of genetic modification of the product. So wheat is still fine. And in fact, I make bread with wheat flour all the time. And you know, for people who are not allergic to gluten, wheat still is a fine product. I forget which one you got. Corn, you mentioned corn also, right? Yeah, corn may be even actually a bigger problem than some of the other two. And I don't buy corn that often, so I actually am not that familiar in terms of corn. But I think it's the same principle. If you buy organic, like a flour, you don't have to worry because organic is not genetically modified. You have something to that?
Yeah, there are a lot of products out there right now, and they have non-GMO verified.
Exactly, yes.
So you can, if you want to look non-GMO, that's a lot of them there.
Yes.
Have labeled.
Yeah, there are a number of different companies that actually, as their goal is to provide a healthy or wholesome product that is not genetically modified. So we have some options. They may be a little bit more expensive, but we do have some options. And as consumers' awareness increase, hopefully we'll have even more of these, you know?
I always used to cook with vegetable oil. Well, if you look at the label, it's soybean oil.
That's right, you're right. Vegetable oil is always, or the vast majority of the time, is soybean oil.
I have replaced it with coconut oil.
Uh-huh. When it comes to oil, I only use olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, for everything, whether we are talking raw, whether we are talking cooking, whether we are talking baking, frying, for anything, olive oil. And I know it costs a few times more than any other oil, But I believe it's worth it. Health-wise, it's worth it.
I have learned recently, though, we have to be very careful with the olive oil that we purchase because about 80% of what comes into this country has been adulterated.
Well, I'm not sure if that is true. I've visited Italy, and I visited Turkey, and I visited Spain, which are the largest producers of olive oil. In fact, Spain is the largest producer, even though some of the olive oil that we get here from Italy is actually Spanish olive oil. And they take pride with providing unadulterated olive oil. So I'm not sure whether that is true, honestly. Plus, we actually have some domestic production of olive oil from California. I'm not sure whether it's a better one, but we have also some olive oil that comes from California also. I think, sir, you had one and then you, Mom, okay?
I read an article, and I don't know if there's any truth to it, and that's what I'd like to ask you. The FDA monitors, of course, pharmaceuticals very strong. Is there not anybody out there just monitoring the supplements?
Well, a very good question. The supplemental business is virtually unregulated. I'm not saying that it's not unregulated because there are some, you know, requirements, some standards. But when you look, like, for example, the Consumer Lab report that they issue, and they look, they analyze, you know, specific supplements, and let's say they take vitamin C, for example, you know, supplement, and it says it's supposed to be, say, 100 milligrams of vitamin C. And so they test it, and it turns out that, say, out of 10 samples, 2 contain none whatsoever, and 2 contain 1,000, not 100, which is what the label says, and so on. So there is a lot of products that basically is not or provide not what the label says they provide, you know.
If you are going to take a supplement, how do you know what you're getting?
Well, the reality is you never know 100% what you are getting. What I do, again, I take supplements. I'm going to give you an example right now of one of them. And my principle of buying supplements is that as long as it meets the dose that I know I want to get, according to the label, I'm going to get the cheaper rather than the more expensive one, regardless of which company made it. Okay, and that means that one time I buy a product made by this company, another time I made a product made by another company, and yet another time by yet a different company. Now, I'm not sure whether that ensures that I am getting what I need. Sometimes I probably am not. Sometimes I probably do get it, you know. But that's just the reality, you know. I wish we had some type of way of knowing, you know, what we are getting. But the reality that is that we just cannot tell. I am taking algal fish oil. I say fish because they are not from fish, but from seaweeds, right? Algal, EPA and DHA. And I actually don't swallow them. I take them in my hands, and I cut them open with a knife. And then I squeeze them. Let's say I mash avocado, you know, and then I squeeze them into my avocado. And I can tell, because when I squeeze this one, there is virtually nothing that comes out of it. And then from the very next one, it seems like there's like a teaspoon of it, you know. So I can even tell just by looking, you know, in terms of quantity. And then I don't know in terms of the quality. So there's, unfortunately, a lot of issues with them. But that's just the reality. And the FDA is very unlikely that the FDA is going to do anything with it. Not that it is the FDA fault, because the FDA, on a number of different occasions, try to do something with the supplemental business. Every time the FDA tries to do something, the supplemental business, which is a multi-billion dollar business, starts a campaign that the government is going to take all your supplements away. And all you're going to die because there will be no supplements. Kiss your supplements goodbye. Have you ever heard this one? That's a supplemental slogan, or the supplemental business slogan that they came up with. And so what happens is a politician gets 200,000 calls in 2 days, you know, or messages, you know, what are you trying to do with the supplemental business? You know, don't do anything. And the reality is that every time they try to do something with the supplemental business, the rules get actually loosened rather than got tighter. You know, that's the reality what we are dealing with. So, yeah.
Another thing you didn't mention was hyperfilled corn syrup. We should avoid that like the plague.
Well, we mentioned sugary sweets and drinks. So anything, the reality is that high fructose corn syrup actually may actually increase risk of pancreatic cancer, okay? But any type of sweetener, even the best sweetener, whatever that sweetener might be, if we ingest too much of it, will contribute to the caloric intake and it will contribute to the weight status, and by doing so may increase risk for cancer. But just like any other sweetener, the high fructose corn syrup is not necessarily a friend here, you know, so we have to watch how much we ingest. Mom, you had a question, right?
I had a question. I just wanted to add to what you were saying about the olive oil. The best one to get is the first.
Yes, so if we buy the virgin olive oil is always cold press. It's always from the first time the olives are pressed, okay? And that's what I buy, virgin olive oil.
Extra virgin.
Yeah. Extra. The difference, okay, so there's virgin olive oil. There's extra virgin olive oil. There's extra, extra virgin olive oil. And there's extra, extra, extra virgin olive oil. That's the types, okay? And the difference between them, they're all cold press. The difference between them is the quantity of fatty acids that are floating free in that mixture, okay? Fatty acids are part of what we call triglycerides. That's a chemistry of fats, you see? And in nature, fats come as what we call triglycerides. It's a term for a chemical structure, okay? And as long as they are kept as triglycerides, these fatty acids are all fine, okay? No issues with them. But then if they split from the triglycerides and they float individually, okay, then they cause the fat to go rancid, right? To spoil, basically. So this designation, virgin olive oil or extra virgin or extra, extra, and so on, has to do with the quality of these, okay? With this in quantity of the individual fatty acids. I think if we buy, you know, the most common one available is the extra virgin olive oil, and that costs somewhere between $7 to $10 roughly or so per liter. You know, I go to Sam's Club; it's a 3-liter bottle, and I forget now $15 or $16 or something in Greenville, North Carolina, where I live. You know, so that's what I buy. Yes, Mom.
Somebody mentioned in that you said wheat now has gotten to much higher gluten. As it turns out that if you buy, and you mentioned Ethiopian bread, the catch is if it's sprouted, which Ezekiel is, the sprouting process, as it were, you know, if you plant a seed, mm-hmm. it sprouts. In the sprouting process, it needs food, mm-hmm. and it eats the gluten.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a tendency for gluten, now if you're celiac, probably not.
Yes.
But if you're sensitive to it, and not as I am,
yes.
and you buy it, something that is sprouted, you're going to have a lot less and probably a lot less trouble. And if you like here in town, there's one line kind of semi-related to me. You buy your pizza.
Mm-hmm.
He's Italian, and every night he makes dough and rises so that it's true. sourdough. Mm-hmm. And it lowers that gluten. And the gluten is something that a lot of people are having problems with. So both of those processes,
yes.
If you do either one, it'll lower it.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. So germination and then the treatment of the dough with living agent, like a yeast or what you mentioned, the sourdough, okay? So when you compare the content of the dough when you start making the bread versus just before you put in the oven, okay? Like if you make sourdough, there is a big difference in between them. Okay, so that's absolutely correct on that.
Well, where we call it Center South, there's Pizzeria de Napoli, mm-hmm. and he's related to my son-in-law. But every night before, and he makes the dough, and it rises all night long, mm-hmm. and then he makes it.
Yes. So, But again, remember, we have people who are sensitive to gluten and or may have celiac disease, and these people need to watch for this, okay? Because we have a huge population of Middle East, Northern Africa, other regions of the world where they eat bread without yeast. Pita bread, a simple example, right? Morocco, Egypt. Again, the Middle East and few issues because they don't develop as much gluten sensitivity as people, say, in U.S. or other countries. So if we don't have, wheat is an important dietary a product from which we can benefit in terms of fiber intake, magnesium content, even iron and other nutrients. A lot of phytochemicals, and so if we don't have to remove it, we shouldn't. But if we have to remove it, then we should think of how we can replace it, whether it would be rice or whether it would be another type of grain that doesn't contain gluten. You would need to replace it because we get a lot of benefit in terms of nutritional content from wheat. So.
By removing wheat out of my diet, I lost 42 pounds last year.
We praise God for that, yes. Yeah. I thank you for being patient, and I again apologize for being late. I won't be late tomorrow, I promise. I'm only about 5 miles from here where I'm going to stay, so I will continue. What time, Pastor?
1:30.
At 1:30 tomorrow, okay?